Welcome to episode 9 today of the Turfcast podcast, and Ryan and I here were just having a quick little chat, but we didn't do too much chatting here before we get started, so we can kind of go right into it today. But we were touching on the fact that, you know, we're both kind of busy during the fall time, and then now all of a sudden it gets to sort of a lull and going into winter, and we feel, at least myself, I feel like I don't know exactly what I'm doing with myself for a little while there. There's a transition period. So how are you doing, Ryan?
I feel the exact opposite. I can't wait. This is like crossing the finish line of like the Turf Ironman race. You know, every year it feels like this. And personally, I love November, December, just kind of taking it easy and riding it out. And I think that'll be a good podcast too, for maybe it's episode 10 or something here coming up, but just a time to maybe take a look back at the year and figure out what you did well, what you didn't do so well at, while it's all fresh in your mind. But man, I just love having my, you know, the feeling that I have my shit together, you know, for the first time in like 6 months, like, you know, my brain's been going crazy and my body, everything like that. And so, you know, you get to slow down and just breathe it in. But I can understand for you that it's hard. It's hard. I used to be like you.
Yeah, well, it's just, especially with me doing, you know, creating so much content constantly and having sort of that going on in my brain where I'm always thinking a couple steps ahead and what's coming up next. And then all of a sudden it sort of feels like all of that's done. And I went about 2 weeks now before I posted a video. And then I finally was like, okay, I've got to finish at least some kind of video here. But it just is weird because I'm so used to the constant, what's next? What am I going to create? And then that sort of ends and it feels very strange to me.
So you need to head up like the support group for the people that are like you, and then you can film that and people will, you know, feel drawn into, you know, you being vulnerable about, you know, being an addict, you know, to lawn care and grass, and specifically perennial ryegrass too. And that's one that you can grow year round if you have the right climate.
Yeah.
I think we're going to talk a little bit about that here too, because man, that winterizer video that you put out, that you and I had talked on, that really, I wouldn't say ruffled feathers. It certainly wasn't a scam video. That's for sure.
No.
But, I think it did, maybe cause some more questions than answers for some folks. And we did have some of those come in. Did you happen to see some of those that came in there on the YouTube comments?
Yeah. And I think one of the best things that you and I talked about afterwards was that some of them that said, you know, we are the only ones on the internet who have ever said any of this info before. So it's us two versus the world. And we're taking on the turf industry here with some info as though we wrote all of these articles that we were referencing, which we did not, but
well, yeah, I mean, clearly that now that Oregon has legalized street drugs and everything like that, we can really expand our minds and really delve deep into this research. I'm really excited for that. PSA, not into drugs. I'm just saying that to be funny. But again, like, this is all stuff that, you know, we talked about in the video, that somebody else challenged these dogmas. Scientists challenged these dogmas. We're merely, you know, saying what they've said, right? Repeating that part of it. But oh, by the way, this has been out now for like 10 years, you know, this concept. And they've been kind of refining it here and there a little bit. But for the most part, this is starting to be ground tested by, you know, professionals and even folks in the residential home lawn community too. So it's not that we just up and decided, hey, you know what? What's the old line from My Cousin Vinny, his opening argument? Everything that guy said is bullshit.
Yeah.
That's not at all the way that we approach this. And so I think it's more along the lines of just trying to find a better way, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I think you do that a lot with your content. And I'm sure that you could probably go back and find contradictions and things where, well, you know, back in 2015, Ryan, you said this, or it's like,
oh, yeah.
I did.
Yep.
And.
And I learned some new things, and I'm not afraid to say that I learned some new things. That's, I think, what has always been the same, the thing for me on the internet is, like, you can either take a stand on a lot of things, which is kind of crazy because it's just, you're going to end up losing at some point because somebody's going to find something. It's, you know, it's just the internet. So for me, I've never said that. I've always said, this is what I'm trying to do. This is what I'm learning. This is where I'm at right now. If I find something else and it works better, or I was wrong before, perfect. Like, there's no problem with that. That's how everyone learns anything.
No doubt. And I think the thing we saw too, we had people asking about, you know, what, well, you didn't tell me exactly what product I should use. And I, you know what I did, we talked about ammonium sulfate and urea, you know, two quick release forms that you can use. We didn't really go much deeper than that. And I understand that we could probably be a little bit more descriptive in those, in that regard. But on the same side, people that are chasing products, like just the perfect product or the, or a good product, like you're always going to be in that chase because there's always somebody out there. And we've talked about it on here before. There's always somebody out here who'd love to sell you something that's the latest, greatest, hottest, whatever, that you can get right here, right now. It'll fix everything. The thing that people don't spend nearly enough time on is chasing good advice and people who they can get it from. Mm-hmm. And that's not to say that we are the gospel, you know, we, you know, we're fallible. We make mistakes. I made a mistake on that video. As a matter of fact, I, and a good friend of ours on our little chat forum made me pay for it too. He brought it up and it was good to see that, that he did. Ridge, if you're listening. But in any regard, I did say on there about ammonium sulfate acidifying soil, and I was incorrect. I said something about sulfuric acid, and that's like a way further down the line process. And the basic concept is you add water to it, it drops off a hydrogen ion, and that's what creates the acidifying effect that you get from ammonium sulfate. So again, perfectly fallible. You know, we're making a quick 8-minute video and trying to run through stuff, and my mind goes 6 different ways and I make a mistake. So
yeah,
that's okay. But
well, and I think yeah, that I think it's difficult because, you know, we're, like you just said, you're trying to get out a lot of information. You're trying to, the thing that's hard about YouTube for me, and we've talked about this before too, is talking to such a broad audience because you're trying to cover all of the info, but you're also trying to give beginners something that isn't way over their head. But then the more advanced people who have already heard you talk about this before are like, yeah, I know this, Ryan. Like, what else do I need to know deeper than this? And you're trying to do that all in one conversation, which can be kind of difficult. So, yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I think the you know, if the goal, and I think your goal is truly this, is to bring value to people. And I think that's why we talk on here too, is that we enjoy sharing, right? And you enjoy creating content. And I enjoy sharing and hoping that people want to do a little bit better and be inspired to do that. That's just a part of it, is that you're not going to always get the exact last thing that you need to do. But we're going to show you and give you value on the framework of what you need to do. And so that's why we have these questions. And so, you know, some of them that came in, we had a kind of a couple of themes that I noticed on there. The one that came up, and it was sort of timely to when you put the video out, is it snowed across a lot of the country, you know, particularly in the Midwest and the Upper Plains, you know, near where you are, and then out in the Northeast, like around Massachusetts, Rhode Island. And so the question was, or the questions kind of formed around this idea of, well, if I either A, had early snow, but now it's nice again, or B, I've got snow on the ground and you're telling me that this is the time to do it, what should I do? So plan A, you know, if you've got, you've had snow on the ground and it's warm again, what should you do? Again, that was probably an aberration in the weather in most places. And it seems like it's been that way. I think you guys were warm up and through the weekend and then it kind of cooled off here. And now that's just pushing through my area of Ohio and it's going to push further east. So it's going to get cold again after it's been in the 70s and 80s and all that kind of stuff. That's your true weather. The snow is an aberration. So if you're still going to do some light applications of a winterizer, so again, all fast release, whether it be urea or ammonium sulfate, go for it. A quarter pound, maybe a third of a pound, no more, but yeah, go for it. That's not going to hurt anything. If you've got snow on the ground, so like I think in Saskatchewan.
Yesterday in Minnesota where my parents live, they got like 4 to 6 inches, I think. So
I did actually see that. I saw there was a sports turf account I follow on Twitter, and they were plowing off football fields in the Twin Cities for football games on Friday night. Excuse me. So yeah, they if you've got snow on the ground, no, you don't need to do anything. Like, that is not going to go where you want it to go. It's not going to get down on the soil, and you could have some problems. So there, you know, there are sometimes some cases where you could do fertilizer of Top of Snow, but that's not one of them. It would be like if we were getting a pre-emergent app out early in the spring and we got a little dusting or something like that. Like, that's not going to hurt. This one, though, and with the grass kind of shutting down for the fall and going into winter, not a good idea.
Yeah.
So,
well, I think that's something else to think about, too, is what we always talk about a lot in turf in terms of thinking about the soil temperature, because it's not like just getting one little 3-inch even storm of snow or something like that. It's not like the ground instantly is frozen or anything like that. So even what I experienced, you know, we had 2 weeks ago, maybe 3-4 inches of snow that one day. And then mm-hmm. we had that warm weather that you talked about over about a period of a week where it's actually very nice here, like low 70s, mm-hmm. all that. And so everything is still going. I mean, here, I think just the actual sunlight, and a lot of people asked me in my last video, they said, well, you're going to be mowing again because I said it was my last mow. And I'm like, well, especially in my front yard, it's more about sun at this point. Like, I was even looking outside today and the angle is just becoming so low, but the sun actually in my front yard, because of where my house is, it gets so much shade now, even, you know, by about noon or so, there's no more sunlight there. So for a couple hours a day, it's just not doing much anymore. And especially, I think I've noticed with rye, it tends to want to just sort of lay over the more that I reel mow it now. There's just not much vigor left there. So it yeah. just, it doesn't pay for me to continue to really cut it when it's not doing a whole lot.
No, I agree with that. The soil temperature thing is crucial. And on native soil, you know, nobody's probably grown on a sand base or anything like that. Those will have a greater fluctuation in temperature in cold or warm spells, but native soil takes a lot to move that needle, right? And to your point too, on the light thing, you know, we talk about sun angle and we talk about, you know, length of sunlight, and those are important factors. But the other thing to consider too is the quality of light that we mm-hmm. get this time of year. So like here in central Ohio, you know, we measure that across the world. We measure it in a term called daily light interval, or DLI, right? And so if we look at how much energy is coming from the sun in, say, August, and then we took points or readings all the way through, like right about now, you know, mid-November, we're losing somewhere in the order of about 40% of our quality or the energy of our light that's coming down. So all sunlight is not created equal. All sand is not created equal, you know, just your typical sunlight, right? You know, but that, exactly. that doesn't exist. And so you can't just assume that because you got sun or this or that. And then too, you mentioned a really good point that a lot of folks don't always take into account is the direction your house faces. So, you know, for instance, my house faces north. The front door faces north. So my front lawn is shadowed by my garage and my two-story house. And that lawn doesn't get, you know, very much sunlight at all. And, oh, by the way, the quality of it is not that great either. So not only is the grass suffering, but you're right, the temperature cools more quickly on the soil, and it takes longer to warm up in the spring. So just little, you know, microclimate type things to think about. But, mm-hmm. yeah, it's always out there, and there's always something to consider.
Yep.
So there was another question, or a couple of questions, too, about, you mentioned climate and nice climates. So we had a gentleman, I think, from Southern California ask and say that he wasn't sure if it was time to winterize yet or not. it's hard for me to project and extrapolate what Southern California winter's like. I mean, I have a pretty good idea. But I don't know that you would have a true winterizer. I think you're pretty much just maintaining cool season turf year round. And even warm season turf, it's going to go dormant there, I think, in a lot of parts of Southern California, maybe not quite San Diego or very extreme Southern California, but for the most part, yeah, you're going to have grass growing year round as long as it's cool season. So that is just more of a 12-month maintenance program.
Yeah, that's something that I would like to go out there like during maybe January or something sometime and try to see what things look like. Because I agree, you know, we have all these people, and especially on my channel, I have a lot of people from all over the place that ask me questions about their climate, and something I've never personally experienced, especially California, like talking about Southern California. So actually going out there to see it in person in mid, I guess you'd say here where I call it hell, pretty much January and February is like the worst. But
yeah.
to actually go see what it looks like out there, I mean, this is my experience from all that stuff. Watching bowl games and being like, well, that weather looks really nice. And then looking outside the window here and being like, this sucks.
Yeah. And all that stuff down there. I mean, they had the Holiday Bowl in San Diego for a number of years, and I think it's still there. And then obviously the Rose Bowl, but you know, what you're seeing on TV is very different than, you know, what's outside the stadium. There's always actually pretty cool is the Rose Bowl. There's a golf course right outside and they park cars on it. So you always see the blimp shots and you can kind of tell how the winter has been going to that point. But yep. Yeah, it's a totally different world out there. So I don't think it's ever a question of winterizing out there. But the other one that came in too was the Pacific Northwest. So like, you know, Seattle, Portland, you know, coastal areas up there in the Pacific Northwest. And what do they do? Because they get chilly. You know, they rarely get snow. They don't get snow very often. My brother lived up there for about 2 or 3 years. So, I mean, I visited him various times of the year and have at least a sense of what that climate's like at different points. But again, I think that's one where you're going to have more of a maintenance type situation. Maybe not to the degree that you're doing it every 6 weeks or something like that, but maybe one final app and then just see how your temperatures go. If they're, you know, fairly moderate, your grass is going to still be using nitrogen and it might not be fueling top growth, but it is going to be pushing some root growth at that time because that's the natural physiological cycle of that plant. So you have to take that into account. And then from there, just play off the weather, I would think, you know, so.
Yeah. I think I was thinking that same thing about, you know, even if you're not doing a whole lot of mowing or even if the grass isn't growing much, but it's still not cold enough to be like what we get where the ground is frozen, then, you know, just kind of watching the current weather and seeing what's going on with it. Maybe you're doing an app like once a month that's a low amount or something like that. But
yeah, and the other thing too to consider there, I think in a climate like that would be getting comfortable with foliar apps, you know, liquid foliar apps, because you're just talking about, you want to put like a 10th of a pound down or, you know, an 1/8 of a pound, something like that. And in those cases, it's much easier to make an accurate application. It's impossible probably to do it with a granular fertilizer at those rates. And that's really the rates I'd be looking to go at. So it'd be something to consider of, you know, looking into, setting yourself up to do it on a foliar liquid basis.
So let's go over, we don't have to go too crazy because we covered a lot of it in that video and then that separate thing that people can watch there. I know it was a little bit of a condensed version, but we still covered most things. But let's go over a little bit of winterizing, sort of the traditional thinking on some of that, and then what we talked about in the video, some of the newer research, which is not all that new. As you said, it's been around here for a while, but I don't think a lot of people have talked about it too much. And so I think let's give a little overview on that, maybe the old school way of the way it was done in the past.
Well, so the old school way was you basically went out here in the Midwest around Thanksgiving or just maybe a week on either side of Thanksgiving, and you literally carpet bombed the shit out of some nitrogen. I'm talking like I've seen dudes make apps that are like 2 pounds per 1,000 of nitrogen at those apps. Now, the recommendations you'll see from land grant universities here in the Midwest, anywhere from 1 to 1.5 pounds of N. And so this idea came from a study that was done by a really, really renowned turfgrass researcher named A.J. Powell at the University of Kentucky back in the 60s. And again, and you think about it in that climate in Lexington, Kentucky, and putting down that kind of N, having a normal winter in that part of the country coming out, I would bet that stuff looked really, really, really great coming out of winter, right? And so it was all qualitative research at that point. You know, there wasn't any, we can, you know, put a radioactive isotope on this nitrogen to know that that's what we put down and we captured it the next spring to see how much, you know, we got as far as nitrogen use efficiency and all that kind of stuff. Like that just didn't exist. The methods didn't exist to do that. Right. And so again, there wasn't anything wrong with the study that was done back then. They used the best means and methods they had at the time. And really after that, because of the results that they were seeing and people would see all around, nobody really challenged that, you know, for a long, long time. And so fast forward to about 2010, and the folks at University of Wisconsin, at Madison decided that they were going to look at this, and they looked at it in growth chambers because they could then control the environment and sort of model what you might see in an upper Midwest fall, winter, spring type thing. So what they had found was they were trying to apply at different dates, you know, basically middle of September, middle of October, middle of November. And in doing all this, they basically put something onto that nitrogen physically that they could go back and look at after the fact to see how much got taken up in the plant, and then also see what was left over in that soil so that they can go push through and look into the next spring, right? So what they found was that if I make an application of nitrogen on, say, September 15th here in Ohio, and I am 100% efficient in getting all that stuff into the plant, when I go and make, which I'm not, it's impossible to do that, but let's just say I was, if I go back and I look at my November app, so if I skipped and didn't do anything until November, or even if I did make apps all the way through November, either way, that November app, I'm only getting 12% of the nitrogen that I would get in the plant in September. So an 88% reduction in the efficiency of getting that into the plant. Now, that's easy to say, oh, well, that just means, Ryan, there's 88% nitrogen in the soil just waiting for you for next spring. Well, no, there's not, because both of these sources that we're using, especially if you're using a fast-release source like urea or ammonium sulfate, they're going to be leached out and gone from that system, right? So they looked at that. They looked and said, okay, well, how much of this stuff is left over into the following spring? And it was minimal. It wasn't anything where they were seeing a bounce that following spring from what was left in the soil on a fast release source, right?
So what about there? Let's interject just for a second.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
In terms of, and I actually saw this question and I saved it. So this was one of the questions I think someone had, said, wouldn't quick release just be washed away over winter since it's not really being used up? I was always told to use slow release for the last feeding as it's more for spring growth, and anything quick would be wasteful and not used.
Great segue into the recommendation, right? So the recommendation came down that, okay, you basically have two choices, and we'll talk about why this happens here in a second, but two recommendations were, one, just, you know, you can go a little bit heavier on your rates in the early part of the fall, in that September to like mid-October range. And then you need to start backing down your rates and lengthening out your intervals if you're going to put down fertilizer, right? Because when you go to make that November application, again, only 12% or so is efficient in getting in the plant, right? So if we're putting down a pound of nitrogen, again, an eighth of a pound is actually getting in there. Versus if I put down a quarter pound, I'm still getting something in the plant. And really at that point, it's not moving in there. So that's one recommendation, is that you basically spoon feed through the fall all the way until the grass stops growing, and then you shut it down. Okay. The other one, and this is what I call the easy button approach, is you go out in here again from Iowa in through Ohio, Pittsburgh, in the East Coast, you know, sometime around middle of September to middle of October, and you do a half a pound of N with a N source that's 50% slow release. So you're getting the benefit of, you know, basically a quarter pound of quick release fertilizer, and then as much as you have going into the system, basically from a slow release standpoint, you can either get a bounce that, you know, a little bit that fall if it's still good growing weather and you're still using up some nitrogen there, or going into the following spring, depending on what source you select. So that's a great question where, okay, what are my options between these slow release sources that might be in there? And some of these are more hard to find. And I think you've seen, I don't know the label all that well on, like, say, the Scotts winterizer.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to see if I could maybe pull that up real quick.
But Scotts is really, really big on using methylene urea. Methylene urea is a slow release form of nitrogen, and it's broken down by microbial activity. So really we need soil temperatures, say, above 50 for that to really have any sort of benefit. And that is one where I would definitely, if you're in a colder climate, for sure, recommend that if you had to choose a slow release source, that you choose that over, say, a polycoated product, a poly-coated slow-release nitrogen. The reason I say that is that the poly-coat is based solely on moisture inside that. So it's osmotic pressure that pulls, you know, from a higher potential inside the prill to a lower potential in the soil, and then it makes that nitrogen available. That's the only thing holding it back, is that sprayed-on plastic polymer that's around each prill. So that gets you into the whole moisture thing, which if you got a wet winter or even have a normal winter, it's going to be an issue of how much is left when you come into spring and how much that's being wasted. And the most important thing here, overarching all of this, is what is the fate of that nitrogen that doesn't make it into the plant? Where does it go? Mm-hmm. Well, it goes into the soil, it goes into groundwater, it goes into all this stuff. Now, you know, you can call me a tree hugger, excuse me, you can call me whatever you want. I believe in good agronomics, and I believe that we can all do better. And this is just another way that we can get the same response, or even better,
yep,
just by changing our tactics a little bit.
Well, I think that's an important point to make here, because I think that when we were talking about that in that video, some people got the sense of, okay, well, you're trying to say that that old method doesn't work at all, and what we were trying to say was not that. I mean, the results that you saw, and I think I've heard Matt Martin talk about this before too, is like one of his strategies that he used to use when he was running his business was like, do that same thing, like hammer it at the end with a bunch of fertilizer, because in the spring, your lawns are going to come out like fire, and then everybody else's lawns, like the competition when he was running his business would be like, well, what did you do to it? How'd you get it to be so green so fast? And it's like, okay, so yeah, probably we're not saying that that doesn't work at all, but what we're saying is that how much of that really has been wasted, and in terms of practices going forward, like this is all going to become under a lot more scrutiny than it is, I think, even at this point, as we continue moving on with environmental issues and all of that stuff. So trying to start to come up with these strategies now and thinking about it and not just going all willy-nilly, there we go, Ryan.
Then
it's just a good way to start thinking about what is actually appropriate.
I'm going to put this in a very succinct way that you and I would both understand. When you're a 30 rack deep, is that 31st beer really going to help anybody out at that point if you drink it? No, it's not. You know, it's just more that you're going to piss in your pants later on the ride home while your wife's yelling at you. Not projecting anything. I've never done that. But again, just think about the excess. That's the thing you got to think about. Everybody has to know when to, you know, when to just call it, and that's good. Cut yourself off. So
yep,
even your grass needs that too, and they need you to be that responsible person.
So I did find that label. If you're curious here, so
oh yeah,
the Scott's label.
What's the derived from?
So it's a 32-10-6, and then it's got 2.7 ammoniacal, 21% urea, 7% other soluble, and then derived from urea, methylene ureas, and there's some ammonium sulfate in there, and then it says contains 6.8% slowly available from methylene ureas.
So 6 out of 32, so it's what is that? About 20 or so percent, a little over 20%.
Yeah.
So that's a fine product. I think that's fine. And that's, you know, not leaving a whole bunch of methylene urea out there for the following spring. And it's going to give you a big flush of growth. I mean, the only problem I have with that product is just it's insanely priced for the package size you get.
Yeah.
But it's not a bad product. So yeah, as much
and
as
I think that's fine too, because what a lot of people, in terms of my audience, want to know, what can I go to the store and actually find that's appropriate for them?
Right. And I think that's the thing, is that you're paying the convenience fee of, I can literally go down to Home Depot, you know, and pick that up. And maybe if there's time, you can swing over to Bed Bath & Beyond. I don't know if we'll have time, though.
Mm-hmm. Perfect.
So the other thing, too, I just wanted to touch on with that is, how do they figure all this stuff out, right? And so the whole premise of this was that the way that nitrogen enters the plant is a process called mass flow. Mass flow is just basically when the plant needs water, it takes it up through the roots, and in that solution of water is nitrogen, and that's how it takes it in. So if the plant doesn't need water, there's no nitrogen, generally speaking, unless you're foliar feeding, and there's some other ways too, but generally speaking, there's no nitrogen going in the plant, right? So when we get later and later in the fall, like we talked about, sun angles are dropping, day lengths are getting shorter, it's raining a little bit more here in the Midwest, the plant doesn't demand quite as much water. And so it was really interesting to see their graphs of kind of this tipping point of where your nitrogen uptake goes way, way, way down. And it was somewhere right around 0.15 inches of evapotranspiration in a day. And it really fluctuates in the fall because we have those really beautiful 75 degree dry days where the plant's just sucking water right out of the ground because the humidity's low, sun's high in the sky, all those things. And then, we've got days where it rains and it stays wet longer and things like that. So that's really what is driving this whole thing, is this reduced need for water, and that the plant's just not taking the nitrogen up. So again, if you get into that spoon feeding approach, you can be more efficient in that regard and have a little bit more control rather than just one big slug of nitrogen at the end. The other thing too, and like we talked about here with the whole Pacific Northwest question, is it's also a good time to look at liquid fertilizer apps as well, because you can have greater control in a much more accurate application and be able to go at lower rates than you would ever be able to go with granular. So yeah, again, just some things to consider there with the winterizer, but it's nothing new. It's nothing novel. And yes, we're idiots, but we're not trying to BS anybody.
Yeah. So let's talk about, I think it gets a little easier when you have an established lawn, you know, after a few years, let's say my backyard before it got killed this year, but 3 to 5 years maybe where you've had a program going, you understand what's been going on. It's predictable, things happening in spring. You kind of know what you should add, how much you should go with fertilizer. But what about for the people who have just been doing, let's say, a renovation this year, and they were going along this fall, they were maybe spoon feeding, they got to this end of the season. What should they be looking for in terms of, should they be doing any winterizing? And then also going into spring next year, what should be their like strategy with fertilizer going with that?
Yeah, so I think in the if you've had a renovation going since, say, August, September, like a normal traditional period for seeding and everything like that, so your lawn has now had, you know, at least 10 weeks probably to get up and going, and regardless of what you planted, whether it was tall fescue or bluegrass or perennial ryegrass or a combination of those three in some fashion, you should be pretty well growing in. And at this point, I think you probably likely would have given it at least an additional pound of nitrogen on top of what you've already done with your starter. So let's just call that maybe a pound and a half, pound and a quarter of nitrogen that the plant's had in the last 10, 12 weeks. I think being on the lower end, again, just maybe like a quarter pound bump, you know, at the end of the year is going to be fine. If you didn't do anything at all, I also don't think it would be the end of the world. It's not going to make a break whether that comes out of winter or how it's doing come spring. And you can always put more down, right? We can always get to that period where if it does look a little funky coming into spring or something like that, we can always give it a little bump and kind of get it going, right? Mm-hmm. So I would not want to have things growing out of control and that lawn all juiced up, especially new grass, right? Those are still seedlings. I mean, the definition of a seedling is it is a seedling until it goes through its first winter and its first dormancy and cycle of breaking dormancy, right? So I would not want to have those all juiced up going into winter. And partly because of, maybe some snow mold activity or something like that, and some of the winter weather diseases and things like that, but more so just from a physiological standpoint, being able to stand up to cold temperatures, you know, prolonged snow cover, that type of thing is what you don't want to see.
Yeah. And I think that comes down to in the spring too, a lot of people, especially when they're really getting into lawn care, they, you know, just come out of the winter season and everybody's like coming out of hibernation and they're going crazy and they're like, oh, let's throw some fertilizer down. And you hear it all the time on TV or on the radio commercials too, like, oh, your lawn needs to be fed. It just came out of winter. So the same thing though, like you're saying, you don't want it to just go absolutely crazy in the spring because you can literally be mowing every single day and it'll just be like a super mess of grass everywhere.
Agree. Your lawn is, even when your lawn is like that, if you've done everything properly in the fall, to take care of it, it's not going to need spring nitrogen. And to go back to our previous corollary there, you slept for a few hours, you're still drunk. If you wake up and have another beer, you're just going to be drunker. Don't do it.
Yep.
Just don't do it.
That's usually where, if I see something that looks a little, or I want to push it a little more in the spring just to get something going. It's the same thing that we were talking about a little bit earlier of learning your liquids and doses there of, you know, maybe a quarter pound or less than that. Even most of the time will give you some response compared to throwing out a bunch of granular and then all of a sudden waiting for it to sort of release and then boom, you can't really control it anymore. It just goes crazy.
Yeah, I think that's something too that we should definitely talk about in the wintertime, is just the ability to have more control over the growth and the growth rate of your grass based on the amount of nitrogen you're putting out there. And those are go hand in hand, absolutely hand in hand. And all you're seeing in springtime is just the projection of what you've done the previous fall, right? In those first, you know, say 3 or 4 weeks when soil temperatures are really getting going and things are waking up and everything like that, you can put stuff out there, but it's, you know, very rarely is it doing anything if it's a typical year weather-wise. So, again, just considerations of be patient, and you can always put a little bit more on, but you can't take it off once it's down, and then you're in trouble.
Yep. Let's transition. I think we covered most of the stuff for winterizer there, but let's transition into some dormant seeding talk. You, I think, have done some more experimenting with this, or at least in our conversations, it seemed like you had a little more experience. For me, I've only done a little experiment last year, and I'm not sure what I was doing right or wrong, so we'll talk about that, but also sort of the concept of what it is, why you would do it, what situations. And I have a couple of situations where I think it's going to be something to at least try that we'll talk about. But so dormant seeding, go ahead and go into a little bit of what that is.
Well, I'm anxious to hear your experiences too as we go through this. But the first thing, you know, is I want to kind of go through the what, who, where, when, why, and how. And I'm going to start with what, because somebody might not, that's listening might not know what dormant seeding is. And while it sounds like an 80s porno movie, it is actually a very critical agronomic process that we do to turf grass. Okay. And so the idea behind dormant seeding is this, is that, you know, we have in normal times during the growing season, so say spring and fall, those are our two prime times to seed cool season grass, right? And both have their challenges. So in springtime, we're going up against all of our weeds that are emerging from, that are growing through the winter, or that are summer annuals that are starting to grow, say in April and May here in most areas of cool season country. And so the idea behind a dormant seed is that we get a jump on those spring weeds, right? So we're going to put out our seed in the wintertime with the idea that as soon as that soil temperature starts to rise to where weed seeds would be emerging, we want to be having grass seeds emerge at the same time or even a little bit sooner, okay? And so what that does is gives us a jump start of somewhere between 2 and 4 weeks, maybe a little bit longer in certain areas of the country, depending on the type of winter you have and everything like that. But to have that 2 to 4 weeks where in general terms, it's probably too sloppy to get out and do a traditional spring seeding anyway during that time. But we're doing it in a time of winter where we're either applying it to ground that's going to freeze, ground that's already frozen, or we might have one of those nice January, February thaws where we've got good soil conditions that we can go out and apply seed and get it going. So that's sort of the what. And so I guess, how did you get into dormant seeding, or what sparked your interest to say, hey, you know what, I'm going to put down seed when nobody else is doing it?
That sounds
like a good idea.
Well, last year I ran into a situation where I had just had so many projects going on, and we had finished my shed. And so there was an area around it that had just been trampled, and I didn't have time in the fall because we were still working on some things to really want to seed that and then just go ruin all of it by walking all over it. So I was like, okay, what's my next best option? Just like you said, I can either wait until springtime, but I have to time that properly, or I have to wait. That's a very good key point there on the sloppiness, because coming out of winter here, the ground is just a complete mess for a while until mm-hmm. things really start to get into nicer weather. So you kind of have to stay off of things unless you just want it to be a whole huge mess. So it's a very good point that that's sort of what my thinking was, is I can get this down and hopefully I can just let it be and I won't have to go out there and do anything during that sloppy phase. And then hopefully it can come up and I have a head start on trying to do that versus just trying to wait until springtime weather. So that was my thinking on it. I think it was around, we had a weird spell, like we, it's not that weird, I guess, but we had a spell there probably in early January that was like mm-hmm. maybe 60 for a couple days or something. And so that was my timing on it. But I don't know exactly, I just didn't seem to have really great results in the spring. And, you know, this wasn't like a great test where I had it in a certain plot that I could really see exactly what was going on, because there was some older grass mixed in, so it was hard to tell what was new and what wasn't, but it still seemed pretty thin in the springtime.
Yeah, and I don't think, you know, you are not necessarily going to get a fully mature, like, unless you have a really, like, you catch it at the right time to get your seed in and you have a really, really good spring. Like, I can remember where we had some winters where it was really, really cold early on, say in December and January, and we did have that January thaw and got stuff in the ground, you know, at a drier time. And then it got cold again for a little bit and then warmish February, warm March. And yeah, it looked like we seeded in fall. Like, it was just that thick and filled in and everything like that. But at the same time, yeah, I've had places where we've had 20, 25% cover, you know, something like that. And it's not been as successful, but those two branches, I guess there's, you know, there's two kind of forks in the road on the how we can do it. And we'll get into that. But I guess the question goes, who should do it? Right. That's our next thing in our list here. So who should do it? So if you just build a home and you've got a big dirt patch out in front of your house, you can do it, but I would not, you know, expect a high degree of success. The people that should consider this would be people that maybe renovated this past year and you've got some spots that you want to try and get a jump start on filling in, especially considering what you might or want to do with your spring pre-emergent program. Same thing with people with established lawns that maybe you had a tough summer, you know, whether it's, you know, dog pee spots or you had an area that just got, you know, trampled by something or just a tough year with disease or insects or something like that. Those are all good areas too. People that might, again, have limiting success if they try and do this would be somebody who's got a really dense, say like 2.5 inch plus lawn that they think they want to interseed better varieties into. The fact of the matter there is you're just not going to get it down into the canopy well enough and down on the soil well enough. And then you're going to also have the competition from all the grass that's there. It's going to be a tough road to hoe. So this is really for like spots, smaller areas, things like that to have the most degree of success because you're just trying to fill stuff in. You know, we use it a lot in the sports side where maybe like an outfield position area where it gets tracked up, you know, playing fall ball and stuff like that and baseball and softball or in between the hashes after football season, things like that, where if we do have spring sports on a certain field, we just want to have a jump start of, you know, again, that 2 to 4 week window where we're getting out and after it before weeds start popping up mm-hmm. that spring. So
well,
those would be considerations.
We're in luck here. I haven't made this video yet, but I filmed a bunch of it last week. So we're in luck because I have those two exact things that I'm going to be trying. One is my sister-in-law on her acreage. She had to have a bunch of work done on the septic system. So a bunch of the lawn got torn up. And so I basically just tilled what was there. And she's like, I want to try this. I know it's not going to be perfect, but I would rather do it and try this now than just wait all the way until spring and everything's muddy. And so mm-hmm. that's going to be one situation. Like I said, I don't expect it to be perfect. She doesn't expect it to be perfect, but I will like to show sort of what kind of coverage we might get on a situation like that. And then number two is my father-in-law. He built his house in the early 90s or so. And so his yard was all bluegrass, some of the older varieties, but mm-hmm. it's changed a lot because of his trees now. So there's a lot more shade. There's a lot of things that have changed with that. And also this season with the drought that we had, they were probably just as bad as us, or if not slightly worse, where he's located. And some of the bluegrass didn't come back. Like, he had some big patches of it that just completely died. And so we just raked out some of the dead stuff. We waited as long as possible here to see what was going to come back, what wasn't. So he's got some really thin areas from thinning of that shade, but then also some damage. And so we're going to try something there too, of getting some seed onto it here, you know, before it actually freezes. And then maybe we'll see also during the winter time if there's a place where it looks like we can get some more down. Maybe some other time when it's, depending on melting and stuff, we might try that too. But those are going to be my two situations that I want to try and show sort of what happens.
Those would be really interesting ones. And I do something to try on those. And we'll talk about it in the how section here, some tricks that might help that, if at all possible. So we talked about the who and sort of the where within that, the when. So this is sort of a big piece of it here too, is you've kind of got two different tracks you can go down, and you got it's a fork of the road. So you can go and do like what you just said was, I remember that stretch in January last year. We have the same thing here where it was like spring-like weather. The ground was reasonably firm. You know, you could go out there with equipment, or you can go out there with a little cultivator tool, anything like that, and kind of prepare a little seed bed and put your seed down. And then whether you rolled it in or you tamped it in or just packed it in there with your foot, you know, really trying to get that seed down in there. That's what I've have found to be the best thing. Now, the pros of that are, I think you have and have seen better success with that route of, we've got good ground conditions. We can do at least some, if not all, of the normal seed bed prep that we'd like to do. And I don't mean like tilling stuff up or whatever. I just mean roughing up with a rake, getting, again, like that garden weasel soil cultivator tool is a really, really good one for small spots in a lawn. Those are like $30 at Lowe's. Really, really good tool to have in the garage. But much greater degree of success in those situations than the other situation, which is kind of going over frozen ground. But back to that other one real quick, is the only con that is there, that exists, is when that weather changes and you get that spell, you got to be ready to go. You know, so kind of sitting there waiting. And to be truthful, we had a couple winters I can think of back in like 13 and 14 where it never came. It was just so cold and crappy out that we never got that chance. And so that's kind of a roll of the dice, but it's not the end of the world. You still have all your supplies. You can do a spring seeding, and now we're just back into some of those challenges and working through that, right? So the other option is we wait until, no matter what we do, we wait until the soil temperature is below 40 degrees. And 40 degrees is our absolute minimum for seed germination on cool season seed. So we want to make sure the soil is cool enough, because we don't want to put this stuff out, have it pop, get it going, and then it croaks, yep. Right? If it gets too cold, or whatever that might happen over winter time. So that's another consideration too, is making sure that it is cold enough to actually start seeding with doing a dormant seed. So on the other side would be applying it to ground that's going to freeze, ground that's frozen, or over top of snow. I've done all three. They all kind of work out the same way as far as I'm concerned. The biggest issue I see with it is seed to soil contact. So if you're going to do it like that, and especially if the ground's not frozen, you definitely want to roll it, pack it, do something to try and push that down in there. That'll help with birds, which become a problem on the frozen ground and the snow part too. Pro tip, if you do have that problem and you notice that that's an issue, go and search for a green laser pen. Like remember the old laser pointers?
Yep.
So if you have, they make one that's green, and you can harass the ever living shit out of geese, birds, anything that flies like hates this. So like the best time to do it is like right before dawn, or even if you see them out there anytime, it's not quite as effective in daylight, but I'm telling you, you could be out there looking out your front window and have birds on the lawn. And if you just flash this by once, they will take off.
One, I thought you were going to say, if you have this problem, go get a shotgun. But two, how did you come up with, how did you figure this laser thing out?
Oh, this is a this is an old golf course trick. I don't even know who figured it out. Probably somebody from Oregon before this was all legal, but you know, man, green lasers, dude, that's it.
That's hilarious. You know,
somebody had that conversation either with themselves or somebody else that they're tripping with. But in any regard, so yeah, so a green laser, probably like $30-$35, great tool to have, you know. And if you have kids or something like that, you want to freak them out and think that you have like superpowers. You're like, I'm going to scare those birds across the street. What are you talking about, Dad? You know, just pull that thing, slide it up your sleeve. You can really mess with your kids and make them think you have superpowers. So consider it. It's a good tool.
Such a pro in so many ways. Pro dad, pro everything.
Not a pro, just tired of, I hate birds eating seed. But so that's a consideration too on the snow and the frozen ground thing. The snow and the frozen ground, the idea is that if we have frozen ground, when it does thaw, that, you know, the ground kind of cracks out a little bit. You always see that kind of looks like bubbled up pancake batter or something like that at the end of, you know, at the end of winter, beginning of spring. And so the idea is the ground sort of swallows up your seed a little bit. Same thing with snow melt and freeze and thaw in that regard. Again, it's more of a spray and pray type approach as opposed to I'm going to prep the ground when I have the opportunity, if I have the opportunity, and put the seed right where I want it, pack it in just like I want it, make sure I have the seed soil contact just like I want it, and hopefully increase my chances of success, right? Mm-hmm. So those are the two tracks when you think about it. So you kind of choose which one, maybe play around with it and see. I'd be interested to see your two different scenarios.
Yeah, so
there, because those are going
to my projects there, let's just talk about those as examples of maybe what you're thinking would be. I do have a roller available out. Well, I can bring mine for both projects, but I do have a bigger one, I think, out on the acreage one that we can roll all that stuff in. I already like leveled everything and got it sort of, the cultivation is done, and then I just ran around with a four-wheeler and a drag and sort of got everything leveled out. So it's soft now, but...
Well, the rain's going to settle that stuff down. That's not going to be an issue. As long as it's not like sticking to your tires, I'll be honest with you, I like a tire roll on something like that. So like the four-wheeler tires would be like perfect. Mm-hmm. You know, if you watch them, it's a completely different scenario because it's a fall seeding or a spring seeding. But when you watch them seed on golf courses, particularly on sand base, but it works on soil too. We use it all the time on soil, but tracking in with those like knobbier tires is about as good as you'll ever do, better than the little cultipackers that come on the back of a slit seeder or anything like that. So mm-hmm. far and away a better deal. You know, the other thing too to consider, and I'll be interested to hear, is what type of grasses are you using? The only reason I ask that is because not that one is favored over the other, but the one thing to consider would be your seeding rates. It's a good idea, rule of thumb, to just bump that up maybe 20% over what you might normally do. You know, so if you're normally at, you know, say 2 pounds of bluegrass per thousand on overseed, go ahead and throw a 2.4, 2.5, whatever you can calculate, and go with that.
But I think
what are the mixes?
I think we're looking at fescue with probably maybe a little bit of bluegrass mixed into that, or maybe a slight amount of rye. I haven't picked that out exactly yet, but I know she wanted to go with something just because of it being out in obviously natural irrigation and all that stuff during the rest of the year, something that's going to withstand all that a little bit better.
Yeah, and something in that case, I mean, I'm not sure how big the area is, but something else to maybe throw out there just to help would be like a little bit of annual rye, just to, you know, for erosion control and things like that, just to help you get through winter, because once that stuff dies off, you mow it out, it'll croak anyway. Mm-hmm. And then all your desirable stuff comes in behind it.
Yeah, I could look at something like that for sure.
So what about at father-in-law's place? What's that looking like?
I don't know for sure. He really wants to eventually do a full renovation probably, and he doesn't have irrigation either, and it's something that he's kind of been wanting to do for a while, but now he's always sort of just been like, I don't want to spend the money, and then now my wife's always like, your son-in-law this is what he does. Like, if you want to do this, like, let's do it.
You're in the background behind your wife saying, do it.
Yeah. So I'm not sure. He kind of wants to maybe see what my fescue does that I have in my backyard that is looking really, really good right now. But I think everybody has that idea of the old school fescue, like, oh, I don't really like the way that looks. Yeah. But then now I'm trying to showing him, like, okay, I think this could be a better option. And so that's what we're thinking about. Maybe doing just a Band-Aid approach to get something looking better in the spring and then figuring it out in fall, but I'm not sure yet.
Look at you. You know what? You are like the Bob Ross of turf, because your happy little accident is going to be causing so much joy for so many people, Ryan. Think about that.
I don't know about that, but okay.
Maybe. Think about it. Just think about that. So then, you know, we talked a little bit about why in terms of getting that jump start and everything like that, but you know, it's something to consider, because you know, it's pretty low risk. Like, you're not going to have to go out there and water it unless you're in a really, really, arid winter climate, like say out there in Nebraska or stuff like that, where it gets really, really dry, Colorado, things like that over the wintertime. Here, you know, from you out east, it's wet enough that you're not going to have to do anything to it. No. So as far as the time and attention that it needs, it's sort of like one of those set it and forget it. And you hope that you get a pretty good take out of it when it's all said and done. Mm-hmm. So something to consider there.
You know, so what would you think about timing on sort of both of these projects in terms of what you would want to do in an ideal situation?
Well, back to that when part. So I'm a big fan of that middle to end period. So like anywhere from mid-January until, you know, early March, you know, depending on where you're at in the country and all that kind of stuff. But I don't, you know, you can do it, you know, if we get cold enough here in November and December. And if you don't think you're going to have the ground conditions and you just want to pull the trigger and you don't want to wait, like, go for it. But I've found that, like, going too early sometimes, like, you'll either get enough of a warm up that stuff will pop and get going, and then you have problems there, or it just sits out there too long and you don't have the right conditions. So it's really weather dependent. And each winter is different. And as much as we think they all suck, they're all different enough that it causes problems, or it helps you, it makes you look like a hero. And so I wouldn't have any problem doing it then, but if I had my choice and I knew I had a stretch in December, I was like, oh, you know, this looks good, I'd probably hold my cards and wait and to play them until that January, February time, or March if we really had to. So, but then you run the risk of, you know, the later you wait, it takes longer for that stuff to come up because it hasn't, you know, broken the seed coat, hasn't had all that moisture to get inside of it like all the other seed that's had. That might have gone out sooner in the winter. And so you run into that same issue where, just like on the back end of fall where you can seed too late and have it die, you could seed too early in the spring, have a warm up, it gets going, and then it's done. So again, this is why you don't do it over a whole lawn, because that's a significant amount of money you're throwing out there. But if we're talking about, you know, somewhere between 10 and 150 square feet of patching and stuff like that, like, yeah, go for it.
Yeah. Yeah. And that big patch that we're doing, I don't know, it's a decent amount of space, but like I said, my sister-in-law just kind of wants to try this. I think it's a good experiment for me to see what happens with it, what kind of coverage you can actually get on more of a bare ground situation. But yeah, I mean, in an ideal situation, I probably wouldn't want to do that whole large area, but I either have to do that or I have to wait until spring. And I've got to deal with what we were just talking about earlier with spring.
How about I throw in a couple plot twists for that one at your sister's place?
Okay.
All right. So we've not talked much about covers on here, turf covers and blankets, right? So it's a thing that's used quite often, especially in the upper Midwest, Minnesota, places with harsher winters, where they'll cover like putting greens, for instance, at golf courses. And so these blankets can be anything from like a non-woven fabric to a plastic material that basically creates like a greenhouse effect over top of the turf, right? So I'll show you a link to a tweet a guy I work with that I kind of set him up with one of these blankets, and he did a dormant seed, bare ground dormant seed, like end of February here last year, put it under a blanket, and it was completely grown in 6 weeks by beginning of April. So again, those are a really cool tool. I'd be interested of just using like the cheapy fabric covers, which you can get for like $35, and then you just pin it down with some sod staples and you're good to go. You just got to be careful. It doesn't, you know, get too big of sections that can blow in the wind and stuff like that. So you might want to piece it in, but I'd be interested to see how that does. And then the other piece too, that can be effective, is lightly top dressing with some compost over top. You know, so if you had three treatments that was, hey, here's a bare ground dormant seed, here's a lightly top dressed, you know, compost dormant seed, and then a covered dormant seed, just see what happens.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
You know, it wouldn't have to be huge areas either.
Because my main concern about waiting until to do the spring, especially with the ground that was, you know, all cultivated and everything, would be what we can talk about here is pre-emergent. Obviously, timing, we'd be going much, much later. And I've seen these scenarios before, even in my own yard, when it was originally renovated, that just that first summer, everything pretty much becomes a weed patch of, you know, foxtail, crabgrass, everything that loves to take over so easily. And then you're just sort of fighting that all the time.
Yeah, I think that's the other thing too, is that when the covers expedite this a lot better. So like if we, I'll give you an example, is like right now on some sports fields, we're using covers. So it's postseason. We've been done for maybe a week or so. And we've got some areas that we've covered already that are pretty beat up. They might be like between, say, 35 and 50% coverage right now of existing turf. So we'll overseed those and then roll it in and then cover those. And the goal is to cover them. And then when we do get that thaw or that, you know, 40 degree stretch or something like that, come December, we should have really, really good growth and coverage at that point, pretty near 100%. We'll pull those off, let those plants harden off, you know, and go dormant. And then in the springtime, that area is now ready to just do a regular pre-emergent. Like, we'll just go over the top. And usually on some of those areas, we'll wait and do dimension, because dimension or dithiopyr, we get not only pre-emergent control, but we also get early post control. So up to 2 leaf stage on crabgrass, so we can be a little bit late and still be okay and take care of anything that might have emerged a little bit early. So that's something to consider. I think prodiamine in a situation like this is completely off the table. Like, you're asking for it by doing something like that. And by asking for it, I mean, you probably won't have very much crabgrass, but you probably won't have very much of any grass.
Yeah.
So
yep.
Something to consider there. So it comes then to tenacity, and using tenacity at say a 4 to 5 ounce rate per acre, and doing 2 apps split up 3 weeks apart, and using that as your initial coverage. And then you can come back after that with a dimension or prodiamine. Again, dimension and prodiamine, both in the same classification of herbicides. You just have that added benefit with the early post on the dimension. So, and the residual is a little bit longer on the prodiamine. So just something to consider when you're looking at those things. But I would be looking more towards the tenacity route, and then being prepared to spray out post on any of the summer annuals.
Okay.
So,
yeah, I've been thinking about getting some of those blankets too for my home yard. That's what I was thinking.
If you're going to go home yard, you got to make the investment and do how big is your front yard? What's the dimensions on it?
Oh, it's only, let's see, like the main front section, like 2,500 square feet.
Yeah, you could, I mean, under $1,000 for sure. And maybe even less than that, you could get the plastic ones, like the good ones that'll last a long time or whatever.
But yeah.
Even just the fabric ones. I'll send you the links and we can throw it up on your channel and on the Twitter feed and everything like that of places to get them fairly cheap. And again, the biggest thing, the cheaper ones, the fabric ones, do have a tendency, they can rip, and they can be very prone to damage in the wind. So it's just really important that you tack them down tight. You can put staples in the middle of them. You're not going to hurt anything, but you want to, you know, staple the perimeter of it kind of in a picture frame. you know, going every foot or two, mm-hmm. With those sod staples. And then, yeah, you can lay down a piece of rebar or something, you know, skinny, that's not going to, map down your turf, you know, underneath a blanket in the middle, but something that's got some weight to it. But I think you'd be impressed with, the conditions. But I'm a big fan of either start early with the blankets, grow in, and then pull them so that they can, we can allow the turf to go dormant, or we allow the turf to go dormant first, then put them on so that we're greening up earlier in the spring. So yeah, that might be a late January to mid February time frame of putting them on. And you can put them in as long as the ground's not frozen, and you can put the sod staples in, you can go for it. So
cool. I think that's something to think about. We can chat a little bit more about that. And like you said, we can throw up some links to some products too, but it's something I hadn't really thought about too much. So I might try to, at least, even if it was one area, experiment with something to see what the differences are.
Well, and the other good thing here too is one to keep, you know, to keep those neighbors on their toes and make them not think that, you know, you went away for 3 months, or, you know, that you're still completely batshit crazy. Like, you can get a blankie for your lawn.
Well, yeah. One time, I'm not joking to you, Ryan. I told my wife, like, one, I love snow, but I was like, you know what? It'd be much better if when we get really, really cold spells, like, there's been times here where it'll get to negative 25 and there's no snow cover on the grass, and I'm just, like, freaking out. So I was like, can I get a snow machine so I can, like, go out there and blow snow? And she's like, this is the craziest thing you've ever said in your entire life. I'm like, I'm not joking, though. I would like one.
You're a problem solver. You're a problem solver. I've just come up with a much more efficient way for you, you know, your water bill for sure, and hopefully for the sanity of your wife, that you know, why does it sound like there is a 30 horsepower blender right next to my ear? Oh, that's because the snow machine's right outside of our bedroom, honey, and I had to run it tonight.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's probably not a good thing. So, but no, I think, you know, the dormant seeding topic as a whole, you know, I don't know if it's so mysterious or whatever, but it's one of those things where you're going to fail some of the time. You're going to be successful some of the time. I can't give you a batting average, because it just really depends on that winter. But again, for the cost of doing it on a small scale. So again, patching in areas that you've had that didn't come in so well on a renovation, or areas like your father-in-law had just tough summer or whatever, and you want to try and get a jump start on it. It's a pretty low risk investment, because again, too, it's not like a spring or a fall seeding where you're going to be fighting weeds and having to water it in the spring, or having to water it all the time and babysit it in the fall. Mm-hmm. So that's your time's the most valuable thing that you have. And sometimes people don't realize that part of it. But when it comes to this stuff, you know, now you've got all the time in the world, Ryan, so we should get those blankets out and try them out, right?
Yeah, exactly. I've got all the time in the world. Maybe, but
it'll be good content nonetheless.
Yep.
Nonetheless. So, well, hey, I think that's a pretty succinct show. We packed a lot into almost an hour there. So
yes,
I think next time we've got to talk about that taking stock in 2020, and we'll leave all the other BS out of it, but just grass in 2020. What do we see, and how can we evaluate what we're doing and where we're headed while it's still fresh in our mind? I'll be anxious to hear your thoughts. I need to kind of jot down everything I saw and don't want to see myself do next year, or see the grass do next year. So I think that could be our next episode 10 already.
Yeah, that would be good. I need to take some notes here myself and try to think about what I know of some definite things that went wrong, but, you know, think about what went right as well.
Well, hopefully this will be the start too of your support group content here, because once we say we kind of go through all the pluses and minuses and everything, I'm sure all of our listeners will be like, one, these guys are crazy and they need our help. And so, you know, we want to be there for them in the support group. And two, they'll realize how well off they are compared to the stuff that we get ourselves into.
Yeah, exactly.
No doubt. Well, hey, it was great chatting again. And let's do it again here soon.
Absolutely. It sounds good. We want to thank everyone again for listening. And I mean, I don't know how much we're going to, maybe we'll have some more guests during the winter time. I think that would be good to kind of talk about some different things while, you know, we can't get out and do the work, but at least we could talk to some people, their stories and stuff. So we'll try to work on that. And then, yeah, just gonna try to hunker down here for the winter time and figure out what else I'm going to do with my life. But that's every year.
Every year, Ryan. Keystone is the answer. Just remember
that it definitely is. We need that sponsorship. Someone that knows someone needs to get us that sponsorship.
We will drink your beer on air. We will talk good about it and how much we enjoy drinking Keystone beer while we take care of our lawns.
It's not a lie for me. It's not a stretch. So you know this, Ryan.
I have nothing against Keystone whatsoever. It drinks fine. Does what it's supposed to do. So
yep.
I'm good with it.
It's the first commercial. Now pay us.
That's right. There's your read right there, guys. Get on it. We're going to get tagged on Twitter now.
Yep.
So, all right, Ryan. Well, hey, we'll talk soon, okay?
Sounds good. Thanks again. Talk to you later.
All right. See you.